we talk about the 80s.
It seemed to me that it might be of interest to future students of design if you could review what seems to have been a turning point in both General Motors design and the automotive industry design, the 80s being a sort of a turning point from the old days and then the new era is upon mm-hmm. us in design technique, philosophy, and so forth, and how that might fit in with your own concept of what design should be in the rest of the 20th century.
Sure, Dave. Earlier you used the word evolutionary rather than revolutionary. I believe that we did both in the 80s. I think our products were revolutionary in that we took a lot of size out of luxury sedans and Toronados and Rivieras and everything we've done in the 80s. And there was a cultural shock involved in the marketplace due to the size differential. And because we were taking as much as 2 feet, in the case of our luxury sedans, off the length of the car, we felt it necessary to maintain all the cues mm-hmm. involved in those products, such as a Cadillac Sedan DeVille or right. Buick Park Avenue. You had to retain that personality when you made that drastic a change in size. Two, I'd like to point out that a basic philosophy that permeates General Motors design staff, and that hasn't changed from the days of Harley Earl right up until my tenure in this office, is that we maintain the divisional personalities through the years. We try to project those forward without doing a 180-degree turn on the customer. I think it's important from a marketing point of view because the people who are driving our vehicles today that are 1 to 5 years old are still and feel like they are members of the General Motors family. An Olds is an Olds is an Olds. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about a 78 or an 80 or an 85, you recognize an Oldsmobile on the street. Some of our competitors have done a 180. They had very harsh, stiff-looking automobiles, and then suddenly in 1 year, they bring out what the media calls a jelly bean. I probably wouldn't use that term, but that's how they refer to it. Well,
I suspect they were forced to do it, don't you think?
Perhaps. Yeah. Perhaps their share of market was slipping, and I guess they had to make some drastic change. I think if we faced that, we would have done it in a different way. Mm-hmm. Where are we? Where do we go next?
Well, what you were about to talk about the evolutionary approach in General Motors design of the 80s.
No, I thought I was covering that, Dave, when I said when you make drastic changes in car size, you've got to maintain right. the cues that telegraph a Cadillac or a Pontiac exactly. or whatever brand name you wish to discuss. And as we march into the future, and I just left the patio a half hour ago looking at some vehicles we have out there for the 90s. Mm-hmm. And while they are radical in form, you could walk out there, you, today, David Crippen, and identify each and every one of them. You'd look at it and say, by God, that's a Buick, I know that. And they don't have labels on them. But you'd know a Buick and a Pontiac and a Chevrolet, because that is our basic philosophy. And we will continue to do that. Take that personality and project it forward into the future. It protects the customer, it protects the used car value right. if you don't make a radical turn mm-hmm. in appearance. That's essentially the ground rules we live by. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any change to those rules. It could happen. But I don't see that anyone will change that approach around here.
The divisional identity then will be preserved at least through the end of the 20th century.
As far into the future as I can see.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now. Given that, which is admirable, what do you see in terms of real change in terms of automobile design, including mechanical and electronic mm-hmm. design?
Well, you know, in the 80s, and I guess the cars out there that reflect my time in this office are cars from 80 on, in this office, although I did influence many vehicles in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But from 80 on, we were pursuing a course of far less chrome than anything we've done in the past. If we did chrome, we were using finer sections, smaller in size, as mere accents to body form and not decorative pieces. I think the future says that you'll see far less chrome, more functional automobiles, not necessarily round cars to achieve low coefficients of drag. It isn't necessary. You can do formal, harsh automobiles and get them at 0.3 or below. And there are some vehicles coming in 87, in 88, 89, and 90 that will be for us projecting the personality of the car divisions involved in these programs, but a far more adventuresome step than we've taken in the past. Plus the fact you're going to see a lot more differential between our car divisions. They will not necessarily share upper structures across three or four divisions.
As you've done in the past.
As we've done in the past. Yeah. They may not necessarily share door panels, which essentially telegraphs the size of the side of the car, because a quarter panel and a front fender are merely reflections of the sections that are in the door. So we're going to have a great deal of differential in our products beginning with 87 and moving on out. We will not only have a difference of appearance, but we'll have different automobiles, such as two-place Cadillacs and two-place Buicks, and something we are currently referring to as a space machine that we will introduce somewhere in 89. And that, I think the public will find a very interesting vehicle. It'll do about anything they want to do with it. It'll carry eight people. You can make a van out of it. You can do just about anything you wish with it. So the variety of products that General Motors will bring to the market in the 80s and early 90s will go beyond anything this corporation has ever attempted.
Most of you are exciting to think about.
It has been an exciting time the last 4 and 5 years, and let me say, too, it has been a busy time. We haven't had a chance to go fishing around here, you know. But, hell, the business of creating new products for the consumer is an exciting profession. I've been in this business for 40 years, and to see something on the street that we had been working on 5 years before and see the numbers grow in sales is a very rewarding experience.
I take it that the question of consumer acceptance obviously is paramount in design.
Absolutely.
In other words, you're out to sell cars, naturally.
Absolutely.
That's the bottom line. In this approach to the late 80s and the early 90s, do you feel that the consumer is ready for the electronic revolution in terms of driving?
Oh, I don't doubt that for a moment. The electronics we use today are essentially used in customer convenience items such as radio and heat and air and so forth, but the automobile of the future will become an electrical mechanical vehicle. Steering will be electrical. Transmissions will be electrical. The engines are largely controlled by electronics today. And you may even one day have electrical power to the wheels rather than mechanical. So while everyone may think that this product is a mature product, that is by no means true. Yeah, the future is very bright. I only wish that I were a young chap starting today, because the excitement I see up the road is going to be something to behold.
The do you foresee in the near future a situation where the driver is now a passenger, and that while he'll give the commands, the actual motion will be conducted by a computer?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the near future, Dave.
Okay.
If you're talking before this century runs out,
yeah.
No, I don't see that.
Yeah.
I think the driver will control the vehicle on the street, but I do believe that the driver will not necessarily have to reach for this switch and that button and flip this and punch that. I see long before this century is out, year 2000. The driver walking to the car and asking the door to open, and it'll open. And he'll ask for music, and he'll get music. And he'll ask the engine to start, and it'll start. And if you're running up the road and it starts to rain, you just ask for wipers, and you get them. And with a voice command automobile and modern computer technology, it will probably be impossible for someone who has had four or five cocktails to start his automobile. With a slurred voice, the computer isn't going to react. So there is a safety factor involved in this approach as well. I see this coming within the next 10 years. As a matter of fact, I have driven a car that the Buick Motor Division has with a system. And of course, the computer can be arranged so that if you have two or three family members driving the same automobile, it will react to your wife's voice or your daughter's voice or son's or whatever. That's entirely up to the owner of the vehicle, how many people he wants to permit to run that machine.
That's fascinating. So the timbre, the tone of the voice will indicate whether everything is normal or not.
That's correct.
If he were, as you say, if his voice were slurred, then the...
You know, if you're slightly intoxicated, you're not going to get that automobile started. You'll have to take a cab home, which is a darn good thing for everyone.
That's marvelous. Yeah. So can you say at this point, in the next two decades, General Motors is leaning toward a voice command approach?
We are.
Yeah.
We are. We're involved with people like Hughes, involved with them. They are now part of General Motors, and some of their technology is going to filter into what we do here.
Yeah.
We're establishing closer links with that group now to understand what they have and how it may be applied here. And I see them making a strong contribution to our future products.
Is this something that you could have foreseen, say, 20 years ago?
I don't think any of us thought that we'd be moving this heavily toward electronics in our vehicles 20 years ago.
This quickly, perhaps.
Yeah. Perhaps a lot of it was brought on by the oil embargo. You look at the modern automobile today, and even the cooling fan is driven by an electric motor, which takes the burden off the engine and gives you better fuel efficiency. And all of these things have changed the way we build automobiles.
I suspect from what you've said that the oil embargo pushed you perhaps faster than you might have gone into downsizing, into a lower coefficient of drag, into customer conveniences, anthropometrics, ergonomics?
Yeah, I think you're correct when you say it pushed us into downsizing, which we may not have done at all, the price of gasoline remained somewhere under a dollar. The American consumer was demanding large automobiles with big engines.
Yeah.
And the oil embargo and the government's approach to fuel economy standards with a law out there forced every domestic maker to downsize and lighten up their cars. As far as quality and customer convenience items and so forth, I think we're running down that road as a result of the competition we feel from our import friends.
Right. Yes.
They have done a lot in the way of little change pieces in the car where you can keep money and places to put coffee cups and so forth.
Yes.
And on the strength of these 25-cent items, they sold a lot of automobiles.
Yeah.
So naturally, you look at what the competitor is doing and look at your product and forget the strengths of the product, find the weaknesses and correct those. And that's what we have embarked on in the last 5 or 6 years. But now, of course, the game is to jump ahead of our competitors, lead them. Not follow them or be equal to them, but lead them. And that's what we're doing for the 90s, the late 80s and the 90s.
Right. Well, I think it's remarkable that you always were leaders in many respects. Everybody else were followers. And yet you had gotten a little stodgy and self-satisfied, I think, in the late 60s and early 70s. And now you seem to be way out in front of everybody. In terms of innovations, creative devices for the consumer, and your market research is no longer, I think, saying, well, what's good for General Motors is good for the country, which is a cheap shot, I understand.
Yeah,
but
sure.
You know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, we were always leaders through a great number of years in our history, but I believe that in the late 70s and the early 80s, our competitors started to close the gap.
Mm-hmm.
You probably could look at General Motors in that time frame as the sleeping giant.
Right. Yeah.
And when we realized that this gap was closing in innovation and appearance and so forth,
right.
We took it upon ourselves to jump ahead. We weren't comfortable with that. There's a margin we like to maintain relative to competition, and I think we're moving in that direction now. Can we stop for just a moment?
I'm sorry, but it's Alex Mayer.
If I might ask you another leading question. In that period that you just mentioned, were you somewhat startled by Ford's coming out of the dark ages, in a sense, of design, and suddenly deciding to make a, as you said, a 180-degree turn,
mm-hmm.
and come up with something they thought was aerodynamic? And
no, Dave, we weren't startled, because the word sort of travels through this community, and we had no idea what the cars were, but we understood that Ford was going to move in an entirely different direction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the rest of my team might feel about this, but I frankly am delighted that they took another course than following General Motors 2 or 3 years later, because everything in the country looked alike,
right.
You know.
Sure.
And I think it gives the consumer wider choices.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can measure. Here, the Ford product doesn't look anything like General Motors, and neither Chrysler doesn't look like Ford or GM, and isn't this the proper way to do business?
Mm-hmm.
And over the short term or long term, perhaps, this will all sort out as to who has the greatest appeal to the public. What approach are they buying?
Mm-hmm.
I don't for a moment believe that we're going to appeal to everyone out there,
mm-hmm.
and that's impossible to achieve. But if we can appeal to 60% of the domestic market, we'll be very happy with that.
Mm-hmm. The whole tradition of General Motors styling, from Harley Earl on down, has been a triumph of aesthetics and creature and consumer comfort over the traditional engineering approach to make a solid automobile. And in other words, you've successfully merged the two traditions of aesthetically pleasing automobiles and comfortable automobiles merged with a good solid engineering tradition,
mm-hmm.
which you had. Earl, I think, was able to bridge that gap, and to some extent, Mr. Mitchell, and I think you've cemented it in your tenure that you don't just design something to design something to bring someone to the showroom, but when they get there, they've got to get a quality product.
Yeah, there are people in our profession, Dave, who look at that three-dimensional clay model that's created in anybody's studio, not just our own, as a clay model.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many of us who look at that clay as steel and glass and plastic and rubber, and it's got to work, and the glass has to drop, and the engine has to start, and it has to have the proper clearance, and you've got to cool that engine, and you've got to seat those people comfortably. It isn't a piece of art that's going to stand in the Detroit Art Museum.
Right.
It has to be functionally sound. We've got a lot of people who believe exactly that, and we may have a few who look at it as clay, and I can do about anything I want with it. It's pliable.
Right.
Hell, I can go out there and defy the laws of physics if I want with this particular material. But a professional designer doesn't attack it that way. Now, I think we have appealed largely to the consumer through aesthetics, because perhaps the greater majority of consumers do not know a great deal about what is under the hood and how this car is propelled. And as long as you put the key in the ignition and it starts, that's fine. That's all they want. And that's what we should give them.
Mm-hmm.
We should give them a trouble-free automobile that runs for 100,000 miles with replacing a few things. And if we don't, we're going to lose the ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're looking for.
Right.
Now, how were we able to lead over all those years? Well, you can go back to Harley Earl's time, and we still live by this approach. It is the young talent we bring in this building that determines what that end product is going to be. And when we tour the industrial design schools, our standards are so high. You can go out to Art Center or CCS here in Detroit, Center for Creative Studies, and they may have a graduating class of 10. We'll select one. Only one has fit our standards, and that's the fellow we'll bring aboard. Even though the need in the building may be for 4 or 5 designers, we won't commit to the filling those 4 other spots. We'll take this fellow that meets our standards. We always run light in this organization. We really never achieve the staff necessary to create all the products that General Motors has. But I'd rather have one 300 hitter than 5 190 hitters.
Right.
It keeps the staff strong.
I think it would be helpful, certainly to me and to future students of design, if we could take a case history of a recent successful General Motors automobile, and from your standpoint, bring us from the beginning to the conclusion.
Something like the Fiero?
That crossed my mind, the Fiero.
Yeah,
how that started, where it began in terms of concept. Did it begin in the engineering department? Did it begin, or the product planning department? Did it begin in the design studio, or was it a combination of all three? Was it a team approach, in other words?
The Fiero was a team approach. And I guess you could go back as far as 25 years, and we tried to sell a two-place car for the Pontiac division.
What was that?
Pardon me?
Which one was that?
Well, it was called an XP number
of
some
okay.
sort.
Sell it internally,
yeah.
You mean. Yeah.
It was internal.
Yeah.
And we called all our products that weren't in the marketplace, and we're trying to sell something new, like a four-place personalized coupe called
right.
a Riviera. Mm-hmm. It would have an XP number before it had a name. And the Fiero had many XP numbers over the last 20 years. And then as we came up into the 80s, the opportunity seemed to be right for Pontiac to get into a two-place commuter for a variety of reasons. One, the new Corvette was going to move into a new price structure and a very sophisticated car as far as running gear and appearance and so forth. Second to none.
Uh-huh.
We believe it's second to none in the world.
Yeah.
You can use the name Ferrari if you like. Mm-hmm. It's a very important name, but this car will do everything a Ferrari will do. Mm-hmm. It, matter of fact, it'll run a little hotter. So the opportunity was there to do what Pontiac was referring to, the Pontiac Motor Division, as a two-place commuter car. Well, it would be extremely difficult to get any group in this building to do a commuter. Because we believe that if the car is youthful in appearance, you're going to do one hell of a lot better than if you do some stodgy two-place little commuter machine.
Right.
And when we started in one of our advanced rooms. Pontiac was just putting their team together. They had a fellow named Hulky L. Dikachi, who was in charge of the engineering program. He visited with us many, many times, and we talked about the goals. He was telling us about what power he'd use. It should be mid-engine. We wanted it mid-engine. They wanted it mid-engine. So we started downstairs in our advanced rooms. All our advanced studios are on the first floor. All the car divisional studios are on the second floor. And we had several false starts, admittedly, and then this vehicle started to evolve from a sketch. And time wore on, perhaps a year in that studio, as we refined this form. A very distinctive silhouette, and that's what we were looking for, Dave. We wanted something running down the street that you'd never miss. It would have a silhouette that one look at it in the crowd of cars and you'd say, that's the Fiero.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had the silhouette, but we didn't have the face of the vehicle or the tail of the vehicle, the graphics that would telegraph Pontiac. And the Pontiac group had now received approval from the corporation to go ahead with the engineering on this car. Not necessarily that we were going to market with the vehicle, but go ahead with the engineering. You can spend X number of dollars and we'll take a look at it again in another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got that okay, we decided that the program ought to move into our divisional studio rather than advanced. because those individuals are skilled in creating the Pontiac personality. Mm-hmm. So we move the car upstairs, and with people like Jack Humbert and John Chinella, we went to work and started refining this vehicle, finding the graphics for the rear and the face, the interior group we cut loose to do the instrument panel and the interior environment. And another 6 months had passed when Pontiac got the okay to go into production. Then we dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's up in Pontiac 2 studio, and the vehicle was released.
Now this final go-ahead, where did that come from?
The go-ahead comes from the corporation, the executive committee.
The executive committee who takes the recommendation of the product.
They look at our clay.
Yeah.
And they look at the cost of doing the vehicle, and then you've got to project volumes to determine if there's any profit in the program or there isn't. And it was called a commuter car all the way through its development, but it's anything but a commuter car. It's a two-placed, youthful, sporty machine.
How'd you come by the midships?
Arrangement,
yeah.
Essentially to produce a two-place vehicle that in no way would mimic the Corvette.
Yeah.
And there were two-place vehicles out in the marketplace, like the Fiat, what is it, X19?
Right.
X19. It was a mid-engine car and a pretty attractive automobile. But we were confident we could bring out something that was better than that, more distinctive than that. This vehicle, in the year and a half it's been out there, is really appealed to young women. Mm-hmm. If you'll note, as you drive down the street and you see Fieros, Dave, you'll see a lot of young ladies driving them. My daughter owns one.
Uh-huh.
She's very delighted with it.
I think you mentioned earlier that someone had decided you hadn't tapped the female commuter market, the young female commuter market.
I didn't catch all
that. I'm sorry. Someone in product planning or elsewhere seemed to have decided that you hadn't tapped the female commuter market, the young female commuter market.
If that was said, I didn't know it.
Didn't know that.
No, I didn't know it. But everyone was involved with developing the concept of the program, the planning people at Pontiac, the planning people in our building, the engineering design community. It was a real team effort. The Pontiac engineers were in our studios more than I'd ever seen on any program. Because here was a whole new machine, a whole new opportunity to give birth to a new personality. That's exciting to a creative team.
It must be, yes. Yeah.
And it's far easier to do a car that has never existed before than taking a personality you've had for 50 years or 60 and projecting it forward. That's a far more difficult assignment.
In terms of the Fiero came on very strongly as a dashing image, but somehow or other along the line apparently the engineers were a little conservative about the powering of it, at least the first year.
I'm not sure, Dave, that the engineers were conservative. I think they were being careful because in no way could this car nudge the Corvette. So selling the program. You talk about a four-cylinder engine with this kind of performance from 0 to 60, and Corvette is that much better, so they're really not related. They're two different automobiles. This is in the $10,000 field. That's in the $20,000.
Right.
They're completely apart, and on that basis, the program was sold. Mm-hmm. But if you've noticed, this year we have a V6 in it.
Right.
The performance is exciting.
No, it's really exciting.
And once you've got the car in the marketplace, you can put in more power and go.
Well, of course, it's hindsight, but I wondered why it was underpowered.
It was. I don't like the word underpowered.
Okay.
Let me put it this way: the appearance of the vehicle suggested it should go a hell of a lot faster than it did the first year.
Right. The expectations weren't there; were there, but they didn't.
Yeah,
they weren't
it just
realized.
Didn't do what what it looked like.
The
excuse me, I have a bad cold.
No, no. So this approach then is unique. With you were able to come up with a completely new concept in a very short time to fill a gap that you previously didn't know existed in
That's
the market.
Right.
That is.
That's
so,
right.
You didn't have any trouble selling the program, do you think?
Oh, there were some hitches in there, yes, because at that time, when we were developing the Fiero, the market went flat in 81 and 82. The car actually would have been brought to market a lot sooner than it had the market remained strong. But the capital wasn't there to invest in a new program. And when the market started moving forward and getting stronger, that's when Pontiac got the okay. We were confident that we could probably beat all records for two-place cars in the first year with that automobile, and we did precisely that. We almost sold 100,000 of them in the first year, and no one has ever done that with a two-place automobile.
Incredible. Yeah.
And we expect to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an incredible story, the Fiero. Do you see General Motors stylistically going toward the wedge?
Not entirely.
Not entirely.
Not entirely. Uh-huh. We'll use that form in certain segments of the market, and we'll use other approaches in other segments of the market.
Right, Vicki, we were talking, I'd ask you a question about whether General Motors will consider that their design scheme in the future will be with the wedge.
No, it will not be entirely with the wedge. It's, as I've said, it's a very diversified market out there. And with all the products we have, we'll use the wedge in certain areas. We'll use other approaches for other segments of the market. You will not see all General Motors cars being round, as an example. At the upper level, we'll probably be a little more formal than we will at the lower end of the market. Sports machines may be wedged. And then again, they may not. You've got to be very flexible in this business. You can't lock in on one approach and say that's the answer. My personal view of what an automobile should look like isn't good enough, because we are not designing for Irv. We're designing for 15 million customers out there that buy automobiles each and every year. So our approach has to be diversified.
In the short time that we have remaining, I wonder if you could... this is asking a lot. If you could sum up in a 10-minute oration, Irving Rubicki's career, excuse me.
That's okay.
Irving Rubicki's career at General Motors, his own personal design philosophy, and what lies ahead for you personally in the next 10 years or so.
Well, my career at General Motors. Fascinating subject. I could, you say a 10-minute oration. I could do it in 2 seconds. Damn stimulating and exciting. And I often, Dave, when I go to some of the industrial design schools and talk to the young people, since my career is winding down, I say to them, if the day I have to walk out of the door, because it's mandatory that officers retire at the age of 65,
that's still in effect.
Yes. And I could walk downstairs into the personnel department and hire in again as a junior designer, I would do precisely that. Mm-hmm. Because the future is going to be exciting. It is an exciting business. It's never dull. And when you think you know everything there is to know about it, some outside force changes how you approach the design of a vehicle, and you're off with the learning process once again. That's what's made it an exciting profession. Mm-hmm. I've served in every studio that General Motors has, Chevrolet, Pontiac, Olds, Buick, and Cadillac. I've worked in advanced areas. I found each step along the way stimulating. I learned each time I made a move, working with different personalities, different approaches to design. I tried to, in almost every case, absorb the strengths of the individuals I was working with and forget the weaknesses, hoping to build a better Irv Rubicki when it came to becoming a professional designer. I was fortunate enough to move through the ranks from designer to assistant chief designer and chief and up into the front offices, finally in this office. I can't say that any one step or period was better than the other. I enjoyed them all, and being in this office has been exciting, and it's taken me beyond just design, because there were the problems of running the total organization from a budget point of view, from a labor management point of view, a personnel point of view. I got involved in all of it, but stimulating nevertheless. And yes, if I could do it over again, I'd stay in the business. And I would suggest to any young man who loves automobiles and has some creative skills, this is a good profession to go after. What am I going to do in the future?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to sit around in a rocking chair and swat flies.
Mm?
And I do not intend to stay in the profession. In spite of what I've just said about going into personnel, if I had that opportunity, I would naturally do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to move off into other areas and new challenges and keep myself young and alive and vital and involved.
Wonderful. One more question, and it's kind of a curve. Following two rather forceful, to say the least, personalities in this office, Harley Earl, who an incredibly formidable character to many people.
Yes, to say the least.
And Bill Mitchell, presumably his designated heir apparent, who was somewhat of the same cut.
Yes, he was.
Although these people were marvelously creative and they hired good people, they were, in a sense, adversarial, in the sense that they were strong personalities. And I suspect that I think I've heard this said somewhere that they were not a respecter of authority. They thought their views should be followed, and that not only by their subordinates but by the officers of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And then a person like yourself comes along, and I have a feeling that the corporation had finally had enough, and they said, enough of this adversarial relationship with me. We want someone who'll come in with a team approach, who'll work with the whole corporation. Do you think that you have filled that role in your tenure as Vice President of Design?
I do not know till this day, Dave, why I got the job.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was because they were looking for someone who would follow a team approach, that they'd had enough of the other, or what the circumstances might have been. I do know this, that over the years, as I watched the two men operate, I believe they were shortchanging themselves because the staff wasn't permitted to really run free.
Right.
And having worked in all the rooms with a great many creative people and viewed the ideas they had, some were magnificent and never got to market.
Right.
I'd said to myself for a great many years, if I ever wound up in that front office, I'd let them run.
Right.
And if they were off the mark, I'd get them back on, but I wasn't going to hold anybody's hand and steer anybody's pencil. I have some pretty strong ideas about what an automobile should look like. But at the same time, if we talked about the Buick studio and the personality running that room, I want the cars to reflect what that group believes within a certain General Motors framework. And I think it's my job to keep them within that framework, but cut them loose so that what they're doing isn't a Chevrolet or a Pontiac or an Olds, it's pure Buick. I believe that what has happened in my 8.5 years in this office, and we'll see a lot of that in the 80s, has produced some very different looking cars.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's the right approach.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what the next man will do, and he'll run it his way.
Mm-hmm.
And I will wish him the best of luck when I walk out of this office. And he absolutely has a right to run it his way. I did it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm delighted with the results.
Thank you. Something you said I very much admired. You said, I fear no man.
That's true.
And that while you're not dogmatic in your opinions, you're flexible, you feel that your approach is the right one.
I feel that what?
That your approach has been the right one.
I certainly do. If I had to do it over, I would do it precisely the same way.
Good. What final word would you have for young designers coming up in the next couple of decades?
Final word for young designers, make your presence felt.
In what way?
If you're in a professional design house, such as General Motors design staff, make your presence felt by what you put up there on the wall as the seat of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Communicate. Communications are vital in this business. You can sketch ideas, but if you're not talking to your neighbor designer in front of you or behind you or in small meetings in the studios, out of these conversations come a great many strong ideas. I know when I ran studios, Dave, and we work a lot of overtime in this building, and overtime hours after the fellows have had dinner in our dining room, they're not all that productive. Now they're fed and they're a little slow, and I would create meetings in the room and talk about the car we were working on all day long and get them to express their ideas. I found that far more beneficial than getting 45 minutes of work, physical work, out of 3 hours. I didn't think that was a good buy. So we chatted about the vehicle, and a lot of great things happened out of those little meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say, young men, make your presence felt. Make yourself heard.
Good.
Don't be afraid to speak up.
Good. Thank you very much. We've been We've been speaking today with Mr. Irvin W. Rybicki, who has been for the last eight and a half years Vice President of Design for General Motors Corporation.
Can we run through